Hey everyone, welcome to the Mass Construction Show with today's guest, Chris Penny, Senior Vice President of Operations at Lee Kennedy Company. I'm your host, Joe Kelly, and this is a podcast about all things construction in Massachusetts and beyond. In this episode, we discuss Chris's approach to leadership, his role at Lee Kennedy, quality control, starting as a laborer, keeping perspective, delegating, and empowering your people. Unfortunately, we lost the video feed 13 minutes into our conversation, so we're dealing with backup audio from an iPhone today. So please bear with the audio quality, and if it's too much, I am also happy to re-record with Chris if this is lousy, because I think Chris is someone that we all want to hear from. Today's show is brought to you by Central Commercial Carpenters in support of our conversation. Enjoy the show. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Mass Construction Show.
Thank you, Joe. I know we've been trying to do this for a little while. It's good to finally get together.
Yeah, for probably almost 4 months or so now, maybe more. Chris, for the folks that aren't in the Boston market, or you know, maybe they're just in the Presidential market, so they're not even familiar with Lee Kennedy, your title is Senior Vice President of Operations. Every company feels like they have different titles, but just so for people that are listening, so they can get a sense of kind of your role, what is that? What does Senior Vice President of Operations mean?
You know, generally the field forces, which is a wide range of support, falls under my umbrella. This, you know, Don Cook, our VP of Construction, he really handles a lot of the day-to-day with different support from general supers and others. But the VDC group, Virtual Design and Construction, falls under my umbrella. The scheduling right now, so sort of those components that all tie into the bigger picture of construction. But the way we're set up at Lee Kennedy, we're very heavily operationally focused in the pre-construction department too. So this morning we were putting a large bid together for a job up at Phillips Exeter up in New Hampshire. So a heavy component there just to make sure we get the right general conditions components, temporary construction, general requirements, all that.
Okay. So 70% of what you're doing is the field operations?
In theory, really, depending on what's in the door. You know, you get a couple. We just got hit with, luckily, there's a lot of RFPs out there right now. So a lot of the focus will go towards that. We get through some interviews next week, and I'll hopefully get to spend more time on the field. Okay. Just on the job sites and just seeing how the troops are doing out there.
Yeah. And then pre-con scheduling where it overlaps, you know, I think estimating has their own head, right?
But like I'm they sure do, but they need all that input, right? You know, where are the winter conditions? How long is the job going to be? What am I telling the mason? When is he coming in the door? So all that we sort of feed to them.
Yeah,
as needed. It's a very collaborative.
Okay. And then VEC is an interesting group on top of. Did they just say, hey, we need somebody to do this?
Hey, I need a new drone. The one we have is stuck up in a tree. That just happened yesterday. But great group of young professionals that are really pushing the envelope. And, you know, not only do they make the proposal stuff really shine, they're a huge support network for the people in the field on, you know, tuning up logistics or looking at what-if scenarios as they move around the site. So they do a lot of different things for us.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to throw under your umbrella, though, right?
It was strange. You know, I think it was 10 years ago we started it, and we had a young APM that had an architectural background. And I said, what am I going to do to keep this person busy 40 hours a week? And then next thing you know, it's a four-person department, and they are jammed, you know, just busy every day with different things. So, it just happened by nature, and it's a refreshing group of people, and just see they're very, very bright, and they're really pushing the envelope as far as technology.
And now I would imagine, does the safety and quality group fall under you?
It technically falls under Don Cook, so under a strange umbrella. It might,
because I think of Don seems to be like a what traditionally might be called like a real outside super, like in the truck, going job to job,
absolutely
making sure, and then you seem more operational in the office.
Yeah,
so it's strange that would fall under Donnie and not you, but it's also strange that you're into BDC.
Yeah,
I guess that's what happens, right?
You know, sometimes it's organic and it just happened that way, and it seems to work. So we just run with it.
Yeah. Now, who oversees the project managers?
It's project executives, our VP/PE level, and that, you know, the some of our jobs run 1 to 2 years, so they will be under that VP. So there is no, call it, general person overseeing project management at all.
Okay.
It'd be sort of a temporary assignment.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Which, yeah, it can be a little confusing for some folks, but that's the structure.
Yeah. No, I like it. And I think people just like to see how other companies structure things or how other people do their jobs.
It's interesting to me because everybody set up a little differently in the city.
Yeah. And it's funny, I find, and if I was smart and I just wanted to like optimize for, make sure we're recording, if I just want to optimize for like listens, I would do the job specific ones. I did one on project managers. Mm-hmm. There were two individuals that, Dave Mullins and Adam Friedman, who you know, were both young guys, but they were both doing, it started off where they both had like lessons learned lists that were like so extensive.
Adam always wrote things down.
Yeah.
Book in his back pocket, he wrote everything down.
Yeah, and not, like some people write stuff down and never look at it. Like he would use it out and he's like,
yeah.
Oh, I gotta buy, I gotta buy a door package. Let me look at all the mistakes I've made in the past on door hardware.
I'd need a lot of books to keep track of all the mistakes.
Yes. And then the other guy, Dave Mullins, did something similar. And, you know, neither of them were like super seasoned or whatever, but they both seemed like they were like pretty good.
Regimented, anyways. Disciplined.
Disciplined and like thorough. And so I was like, let's sit down and let's just talk about, say, like, how do you do your lessons learned, and how are you as a project manager? How do you do it? Dave, how do you do it? Top 10 listens of all the episodes, and I've got 250 something.
Really? I did watch Adam, so I'm familiar with that, but I didn't see Dave. So.
And then, there was one where they were together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then I brought them back for a second time to do more because people were like, this is great.
Really?
No, but what is it? There's a lot of project managers that listen to this and they're like, oh, how does somebody else do it?
It's good because as an industry, we keep things very close to the vest, right?
Yeah. And I think that's why people like this in general, because historically, everybody's been so insular, other than safety.
True.
Safety's pretty good about sharing across
companies. It's a common good there we're trying to establish.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. And that's something that's a positive about the industry, right? Then you say, okay, yeah, we're going to compete.
But
when it comes to safety, let's share how we do this.
It's really accelerated over the past couple of years on the collaboration at that level. It's good to see.
Yeah, Jason and Lee Kennedy, you guys were pretty involved with the CARE program you had AGC put together. If people don't know about it, look up AGC Mass CARE program, like a universal which includes videos. And so anybody who's a small or mid-sized company, you know, you could have a pretty sophisticated orientation just out of the box.
Yeah, they're just, you know, for the subcontractor to show up on site, it just makes things a lot easier for them. So they're doing 20 different orientations across the year.
Yeah, you're right. That's probably the biggest value add, which is, so for people that don't know, it's like a universal orientation. So you take one, I'm guessing there's some type of tracking that happens. And if they were on a Turner job and they go over to a Lee Kennedy job, you didn't just look up, say,
covered their job.
No, I'm doing this orientation.
Yeah, I think it's once a year they need to re-out.
Renew. Yeah. But so like the episodes where it's, you just get, I don't want to say peek behind the curtain, but you just see how somebody else does a job, just do so well. We did one with superintendents, same thing. We did one with Greg Garvin from Gilbane and Peter Campo, Peter Capone, sorry, different, from Consigli. Same thing. It's like chum in the water. People want to see, how's that company doing this, right?
But two very different approaches.
Yes. I wouldn't say very different. The biggest difference was Consigli was very like top down, hierarchical, and Gilbane was more regional.
Regional, that's how they're set up nationally, right?
Yeah, that's the point. So they don't have their, but even now Consigli, that is pretty close to, you'd say, national now, right?
Yeah, I mean, too close. Yeah.
DC, upstate New York,
North Carolina,
of New England. Yeah. But they have it. It's top down linear, and as the head of purchasing, and everything falls under that. Where, you know, if
you're in Texas or New England or Nashville, we're all just separate purchasing outlets.
Yes,
from the Bay. So, but I think there's pros and cons to that.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be an overhead component that plays part of it, right? If it's centralized, maybe you save a few dollars on your overhead, whereas it's regional, you get some repeat positions. But that, I mean, at the volume some of those companies are doing, that's a lot to keep your hands on top of.
Yeah, it was an interesting discussion because, like, Consigli's argument was like, we're getting more purchasing power because we're putting it all in an umbrella. You're talking to one person, be like, okay, right? You know?
Yeah.
It's valid.
And then I think Bain's approach was like, okay, yes, you might get more purchasing power, but we're understanding our local,
the regional
market. Like, so by
expertise and the value they can bring at that level.
Yeah. So if the head of purchasing is sitting in Boston and the subcontractors in Texas, like, is he or she really going to know?
Yeah, do you understand that marketplace to begin with, right? You know, union, non-union, there's all kinds of nuances that go with that.
Yeah, and how are you tracking, you know, how busy that sub might be? Yeah, you can say
That's a very important part.
Yeah, right?
Are we overloaded, or are they already overloaded within that region, and we're just putting more bricks in that basket?
Yeah, and you can know how much work they have with your company. But if you're in Boston and you're trying to figure out what's going on in Texas, like,
you need a lot of resources.
Yeah. So it's nice to have like a boots on the ground thing. So that was the two arguments that we went back and forth. And then there was a lot of similarities in like how they pre-qualled. I should send it to you. I think you would find it interesting.
I would, because the purchasing is not something we do. You know, pre-construction along with our project teams handle the purchasing. So we do it very differently, but obviously we're more New England based. So
yeah. And then the reason I started it is because I didn't even really, this sounds dumb, but in a true sense, I didn't really even understand what a purchaser did, right? Like, yes, I can intelligently understand what a purchaser does and, you know, purchases things, right, and, like, procures things. But, you know, what is that, and how is it different than estimating?
Right.
And also, you're in a small company. You're a project manager. You're estimating in your procurement. So, you know, like,
that's how we started out. Yeah. Right. You know, many moons ago, but that's, you kind of did it from soup to nuts.
Yeah. So it wasn't just, oh, other purchasers want to know, but like other estimators or project managers that are responsible for purchasing want to know. So like how you're pre-qualifying a sub and what are you looking at? And so
there's a lot to it.
Yeah. So those specific ones are kind of like catnip for people in construction,
because
they want to hear. And then the other one, now this is back to Lee Kennedy, the quality one that we did with Jason and Chris.
Yeah.
That was another really strong performer as far as metrics go.
Chris is an incredible individual, just all in on anything he needed to be, just really good. He developed essentially the whole program, and it's definitely paid dividends.
Yeah. And, you know, I found it interesting, like, to the level with which Lee Kennedy was going with the quality. Because it seemed like about, like, 10 years ago, there was, like, this, all of a sudden there was this movement where we need a QA/QC person.
Well, you get burned enough times, and, you know, like, it costs you money or it costs you time, and it's frustrating
for a whole number of levels of people, and just the stats and the data Chris can put together based on.
Like, I'll give you an example. Just first delivery inspections. The truck shows up on site. Go out and inspect it. Does it match what we've submitted on? And at one point, we were getting 4-5% failure rates on massive deliveries. The roofer shows up with the wrong type of membrane. What happens if he puts that on the roof? You know,
yeah.
It's, you know, you're relying on a supplier and a truck driver, and they're not necessarily responsible for that. So just that alone.
Mm. Yeah, and you would say like, oh, well, that's the roofer's problem, but
it becomes our problem.
That's where I go with that, right? Yeah, okay, yeah. Theoretically, you can force them to pay for it, maybe, but you're crippling the job.
Right, yeah, we're there, and now you're ripping off the membrane. We've got to manage that risk involved and time and money.
Yeah, and for folks that are listening, it's worth going back, and if you haven't heard that one, there was just, you know, it's not because Chris is sitting here, but out of everybody I've seen that's been trying to crack that nut, you know, nobody's perfect, and I think Jason and Chris
Chris has got a long way to go too. Yeah. But what he's really harnessed Procore and what it can do for us, and Now it's really developing with those optimized procedures to get it on the field. So it's easy for them to use. It's not becoming a burden. It's you know, it's helping their job, not hurting it.
And if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, it was almost like way you were scheduling. They were bringing in quality for a while. They were scheduling and saying, okay, at what points are we checking and
yeah.
what?
And, yeah. Yeah, we at the beginning of the project, we'll identify sort of the 3 to 6 hot buttons, you know, for doing a new assembly we've never done before. All right, let's zero in on that. And, you know, what are the components of that? How do we mitigate the risk? So it's hard to cover everything, obviously. You don't have that many people, and the job just can't afford it. But if you really zero in on where you anticipate the risk is, it's come out in the long run.
Yeah. It just even, like, I don't know how, and this is another one that all companies are trying to really figure out is, like, the lessons learned.
Yeah, we've got a great setup for it. We just need to need more input from the people that are experiencing it. So get some strategies around that we'll work on the next few months.
Yeah, I think the challenge there is you're asking people to say, tell us where you messed up.
Yeah, and that's not what it's about, right? It's, you know, so stick with the facts. Don't get emotional. We want to learn from it. And don't turn it into a bitch session. It's more, but we want to learn, period. And the only way we're going to get better is if we know how your bad experience is and how to fix it.
Yeah, so we fucked up a lot on this job.
World record on this
one. We've got some great lessons learned for you coming up on this one. So, one, talk about leadership today. It's a funny topic, because it's, I don't think anybody that is a leader looks at themselves that way. You're just like, I'm just who I am. But, you know, the genesis of this was a group of discussions that Wentworth wanted to have on leadership. And, you know, your name came up a couple times. So I'm going to kind of preface our conversation as, you know,
talking to my mother or something.
You know, that Chris isn't claiming to be some exceptional leader. This was, you know, me reaching out to Chris. He's not showing up to say, okay, I'm the expert on leadership. I'm gonna, you know, like, there are these people
Good
out
Lord,
there
no.
that want to, you know, be identified as leaders. That's not Chris. I've known Chris for some time now, and that's definitely not who he is. But with that said, you know, there are enough people that feel like you are a good leader, not self-proclaimed. And I noticed that you have a starting point of labor. How much do you think starting out as a laborer influences, and if you don't want to say leadership and you want to say Mandarin style, whatever, how much do you think that influences how you lead just by the nature of your job title, lead people at work to you?
To me, it was a great place to start. As much as I appreciate the carpentry trade, I almost went that way with the carpenters union, but the benefit of being a laborer, particularly at the time I got out of college, one, wasn't much work in 1990, but you're on the job essentially from the beginning till the end. So you see the whole process, whereas if you're a carpenter, you're coming in certain aspects of it and then leaving. So you got a pretty good understanding of what had to happen throughout the whole thing, from, you know, right through punch list in a lot of cases. And the other thing was, you know, I had a lot of great superintendents that I worked with along the way, and some of them taught you what to do, and other ones taught you what not to do. And you take that all, and it sort of, you know, filters through your brain, and you create your own management style out of those experiences. And then as I moved, you know, I did 10 years, I had a laborer's book for 10 years, but it was probably 4 or 5 as a laborer, and then a couple as a field engineer, and a couple as an assistant super, and then I went salaried. But, you know, as you moved up as a super yourself, and then you're working under a VP of construction or something, certainly you're learning at a different level what leadership is there. But a lot of those early lessons on how to treat people, and you got to remember in that time frame, if the super wasn't yelling at you, you were doing good. And that's not how it is anymore, nor should it be, yeah. But that's kind of how it was. And obviously things have changed. It's a much different industry these days.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure you remember whether you were unloading something or pushing a broom or chipping something out, or, you know, pouring a little curb or something and having to take it out. Like, I'm sure you know how it feels to have someone, like, have you do something just to redo it.
They hate doing stuff twice. Right. To this day, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And, or, you know, and just generally how things felt when you were asked to do things. Mm-hmm. And I think I have to imagine it's pretty valuable to be able to put yourself in that person's shoes.
It is, because it, you know, especially if you're removed from it or you haven't experienced it, which a lot of people happen because they just didn't, you know, they went into estimating, they went into project management. And just having appreciation for the work that goes into it. Is it a one-man job? Is it a two-person job? You know, how are you going to handle, how are you going to get the material up there? You know, teach. Are you going to have them humping up the stairs all damn day? Or, you know, do we get a boom truck? What's...
Yeah. Or even understanding the safety implications.
That too.
Of something.
That too.
You know, like, okay, yeah, you can do it that way, but knowing, having done it yourself, that's probably not the safest way to go.
Might be the cheapest way, but not the safest, the smartest, yeah.
Yeah. It seems like there's a lot of value in there. And also, like, it's human nature, I guess, to some degree, where if you have never seen it from that perspective, to say, like, the chipping out a curb and moving it or whatever.
You're not going to learn later.
You can't learn later. And to some degree, you might think, like, okay, listen, this person's getting paid. Well, I'm paying them to pour it, I'm paying them to chip it out, and then I'm paying them to put it back in. Why do they care? Well, no one wants to...
They care because they take pride in their work, and they don't, you know...
If
you gave them bad... You know, they need good information, they need good layout, they need a safe area to work, and if they're generally going to do the best job for you, they can.
Yeah.
And again, nobody wants to...
No one wants to waste time. It's like demoralizing in some sense, because then it's not... Then you're just a commodity. Well, that's just a person that'll put it in and take it out and do whatever we tell them, right?
Yeah.
But they're not a commodity, right?
And they're not. And there are eyes and ears in the field. You know, we're labor intense as a company than more the carpenter is, and they provide a lot of help to the superintendents out there, whether it's eyes and ears, safety. If they see a sub doing something they shouldn't be doing, they pick up all the super, so it doesn't become a bigger issue. Yeah, that's if you're not taking care of them, then they wouldn't do that for you necessarily. So
yeah, and they have to feel like they're part of the organization.
Yeah,
being part of the team. And I think some of the roadblocks there is labor materials become a light item when you're a project manager. Right? So those are just hours and units.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
There's a human behind that.
Yeah.
Unit.
Yeah, there's a person there. And I think having been there, you're able to understand that, right? So I think some of that are the challenges, right? If you haven't done it, and then you're also just forced to look at it as a unit of measure in hours. But
if you haven't seen the other side, it's the default, right?
So, yeah.
But it even goes down to, like us, all of us, we're getting a little older. So does a certain labor foreman need some young legs on the job to help support them? Because so they're not up and down the stairs all damn day. So there's that personal element.
I never would have thought of that. But yeah, so like making sure that labor staff is part of the team, we're all working the same direction. To your point, they're your eyes and ears.
Absolutely.
But if you're just treating someone like they're a commodity, they're not your eyes and ears.
You know? No, should they? No,
and
you're not going to get the best out of them.
Yeah, because okay, if I'm just a widget, then you tell me how many shovels to
shovel. Yeah, you got me from the neck down today.
And I think having that outlook certainly helps. My opinion when it comes to leadership, I feel like some people have a knack for it, I would say. But I think there's probably a lot of also, I think you were alluding to it when you said you watched the supers and what to do, and then maybe more importantly, what not to do, right?
Or how not to say it. Yeah.
Did you have any like role models, or were there any like aha moments where you're like, okay, I'm just going to put that in the back of my mind and I'm going to say to myself, like, if something like this happens, that's how I want to act. But that's a person I want to be like, or don't want to be like that.
There's a million of them. I mean, over the past 30 some odd years I've been with the company, it really is an amalgamation of all those experiences.
Couple.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. We've had a more than a couple of supers over the years that maybe weren't the best technical people for the projects they were on. We were probably stretching them. Mm-hmm.
but they had such great people skills that the clients absolutely gravitated towards them, and they could do no wrong. And maybe they struggled with what they were trying to execute a little bit because it was a bit over their heads. But they always made sure the client, and even the design team for that matter, was taken care of and happy while also protecting our position, you know, make sure we're not giving away the bag. But that level of customer satisfaction, and you know, there's a couple of people that I'm thinking of, I don't want to name names, but that just were very, very good at that service level.
So would you say that what kind of the takeaway there is that, not that you don't need both, but your personal skills would outweigh the technical?
Listen, we don't survive without the customers. So, you know, there's a balance in there. You know, a lot of it is how much you're putting on a particular field team and, how, you know, who can you support them with along the way to help them overcome maybe that level of technical challenge. But you've got to sell yourself out there, right? I can promote somebody to being a superintendent tomorrow, but if they can't go to an interview and sell themselves and create their own group of clients, and I'll take that person in a day, bring them right over here if we're doing a job. That's so valuable.
We all know the clients that, and I've been in the situation myself where the client is like, okay, this job is yours, but we want
this. I want this person.
Yeah.
And you'll do everything you can to do that because, you know, it's got to run smoothly and the job will be profitable. And
And the client's going to be happy and they're going to say, okay, and you can have the next one, but Chris is coming back.
Some people spent, you know, when I started out, we had two big accounts between Liberty Mutual and New England Life, and those supers were in those buildings for 10 years. Like, they just never left. They retired there. Yeah. And that's that level of care.
Yeah.
And engagement.
Yeah. So you can't be like completely incompetent, but it's the factor there is relationship building.
It is.
Personality. It is. I mean, how many people do we know that are technically amazing, but they're either just fucking
pissing people off left and right. Yeah. You're doing collateral damage everywhere. And, it's certainly not how we want to run our company, and they don't last long with us. It's not.
Yeah, and it's a net negative.
It absolutely is.
Right?
Because you just burned a client, probably. Maybe a design team, too. Not to say anything, not forgetting the people in the field that they're working for. Because that impacts everybody.
Yeah. Okay. So it's an interesting takeaway. Yeah. So the personality always technical.
It really can. Yeah.
I knew your dad, and... it's funny whenever
I blame him for all this.
Whenever you delve into families, it's always a touchy subject because we all know there's people that we love in our family.
He was a great man. He was a great man. We're very close.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that. So I always, you know, you never know.
No,
you don't. But I was a big fan of your dad's. When I knew him, he was just coming down to ISD.
Yeah, doing a permanent for us. Yeah.
But he was the right person. Where again, it was.
Yeah, you're not going to go down to ISD and rattle cages because you will get nothing done.
Yeah, so like he was so even keel and smooth, and you know, new people that like he was a master at it.
Yep, right? always be kind.
Yeah,
because he'll come back to all you have.
Yeah, and he was a master at it. Everybody loved him, and if they saw him coming, it was Paul, come on in, and like he would
behind the counter.
Yeah, and he would coast in and sit in the office and like. If people were happy, you know, to have him there, and then other people, it was like, oh, this fucking asshole. Like, have a seat and then, you know, lose his plans. You know what I mean? Like, and like your dad knew that, like he had a good sense to like calculate things and be like, okay, yeah, that person is a clerk, but they can ruin my my life.
Well, he came up with Harry McGonigal, so then, you know, Harry certainly helped him with the ropes in there.
Yeah. So was he in some sense a role model? Because I think he had that personality.
He was in the business. I mean, he was a draftsman by trade, and then moved into Harry pushed him into the construction management role actually, and he was on with Liberty Mutual for, God, probably 17 or 18 years, and then did a few different things with was at Babson for a number of years working as an OPM and North Ultra. He's definitely. He got me started, and he gave me the opportunity. Well, Lee Kelly gave me the opportunity, but he was their client at the time, and here we are 30 years later.
Yeah, that's awesome. Maybe that's what you'll be doing when you're 70. You'll be,
I hope not. Let's send you pictures from the beach.
Yeah. Any other moments or nuggets that you felt like, you know, things that happened where there was something that went sideways that you were able to kind of learn from?
Well, there's a couple of lines that stick with me from
people.
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
And we had a senior vice president back a number of years ago. He's retired now, Eddie Hines, who spent years with Babby and Walsh Brothers. Luckily, he finished his career with us, and he was just an absolute prince. We had something go pretty bad on a job. I think I drove a pile through a main electrical feed out on Massport's port and shut down the port. Unforeseen condition, but it was a bit of a mess. And once the dust settled a little bit, we're sitting out there. It's like 8 o'clock at night in the dark because there's no power. And Eddie comes out and says, what are you going to do? You got to fix it. Can't go home and suck your thumb. It's just, you got to buckle down and just get over it and pass it as quick as you can without burning any bridges and move on.
Yeah.
The other is Lee Sr., who's, I think he's going to be 90 this year, but he's still around. He still keeps in touch. And I forget what the issue was. There was something going on that was kind of nasty. And he's a Marine, Korean War veteran, 2 tours there. And he says to me, hey, nobody's shooting at you.
Yeah.
Kind of puts it in perspective, right?
I was about to say, both of those things are real perspective.
Yeah.
Right?
Old school guys, but you're going to get through it.
You'll get through it. And also, it feels like both had a tinge of there's nothing worse getting worked up.
Like they've been there, and like, it can always be worse. It's something I always say, because it certainly can't be. Yeah. Nobody got hurt.
Yep. And I think when you're young, and this is good for people that are young, there's this added level of pressure,
mm-hmm.
because it feels like the end of the world.
Absolutely. I was
right.
I think I was a young super at the time when, the largest job I had run. So, my reputation on the line here, it's concerning.
Yeah. And I think you realize with time, the owner or the client or the senior person is going to put all this pressure. Like, it has to be done.
Come down with a hammer. That was not the case. It was supportive.
Yeah.
And they're, as a younger person in the business, and we have a lot of great young talent, they're going to make the wrong decision. And you just got to help them through and support it. I'd rather have them make a quick decision that maybe wasn't the right one than sit and linger on something and not make a decision. The problem compounds itself.
Yeah. I think it's a patent, general patent quote is kind of like, a quick decision made firmly is better than like the perfect decision.
That's,
you waited all of that.
Yeah,
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the quote. And I would probably butcher it worse, but that is the case with certainly with the military, but construction too, because it's everything's time sensitive, and the subs are relying on us to make timely decisions so they can get out of there and make a profit.
Yeah, and even just like when you've got a flood or something like that. Like the first time you have a flood, you're like,
you get used to it after a while.
Yeah, you're shit. Then we're gonna have to like
shit. No,
now it's just like, oh yeah, call whoever,
get
the fans in here and vacuum it up, But I think having that even keel approach your dad had.
I never really saw him get too upset.
And no,
if he did, it was because of something stupid I had done. So.
Yes, that's it. Well, there's a family mix,
yes,
right?
There is.
Yeah, I could do that.
Dumbass.
But if you did, it's the worst thing in the world. So I reached out to a few people, and I heard a number of times that people trust your knowledge and decision-making. And they were talking about it in your knowledge, you have the technical knowledge and decision making. So like they were multiple people said like that decision making is very solid. They felt like, how much is the technical side of things important versus just making good decisions? And that's kind of a strange question. I'm not wording it great, but is it the decision-making or is it having the experience?
It's a combination, right? One is very subjective, the technical, and the decision-making at a higher level is a little bit of objectivity. But on the technical stuff, I've always been a bit of a geek as far as just construction science and materials, facade components, all the stuff that goes in a building. The fine home building is still a favorite magazine. And, you know, we don't do single film residential, but new products, new tools. I just love that stuff. So I've always had a passion for that end of it, even code. Code-related stuff, as boring as it may be to some people, I find it interesting. But sort of the higher level decision making, part of it's, you know, it's based on where you are. You can see more of the field, so it helps. Sometimes it can cloud your vision, but I think it helps being able to have just that different level of view. And then you've got the ability to talk to different people to understand where they're coming from to formulate the best solution at the time. At least you hope it is, but. And it's got to be, again, I do focus on don't drag it out. We need a decision pretty quickly. I think I'm pretty good at that. Yeah. But sometimes you need to clear and you got to think about it over the weekend and the right thing comes to you. Usually at 2 in the morning.
Yes. I want to outline two things and come back to them. And I'm going to back up a hair for the moment. And going with you starting as a laborer, recently I did a poll on LinkedIn and I think Instagram as well, because the topic was coming up around some people asking for advice, and you know, I kind of had my opinion on things, and you know, I had asked folks, where would you tell someone to start if they wanted to be an optimal construction manager? And I gave, they only allowed 4 choices, so I was hamstrung by these 4, but I said trades, assistant super, estimating, or assistant project manager. And overwhelmingly, especially if you combine trades and assistant super, it became 80% of the people had said either trades or assistant super. More people said trades than assistant super even.
Yeah.
So 70 people said trades, 54 people said assistant super, 20 said estimating, and 12 said assistant product manager.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty fair assessment. I think there's a, this could be a long topic, but it's a good one because I think a lot of young folks coming to college now are gravitating towards the APM role. And what's, you know, I didn't know what that meant when I graduated. So taking a step back, I think if there's the opportunity to learn a trade, which takes years and years, decades, it's hard to get to a level of competence there that you're an expert at a young age. But even if you went to, you know, Voc-Tech type thing and had a background there, followed, and not that you need this, but, you know, followed up by maybe a construction management degree at Wentworth or somewhere else, then that's a great foundation. But everybody comes from different backgrounds. They have different skill sets. What we found is we created a role called project engineer, which different firms have different responsibilities out of that. But essentially, it's a starting place for somebody new to us or newer to the industry. And then what we'll do is we'll sort of rotate them through pre-construction. Everybody should spend time down there and understand, you know, the level of quality and the speed with which they put together their pricing and proposals. Spend some time as an assistant project manager, learn the document control, you know, the Procore ins and outs, and the RFI process, all that. And then spend some time as an assistant super, still under that project engineer title, and then make your decision. Which way do you want to go? And we just had a young, and with this almost 3 years, I did 2 years as an APM and grabbed Donnie Cook and said, I really want to be an assistant super. Gave us enough notice and we just got him out of a job coming on the ground now. So it takes a lot of communication and some forethought, but that to me is the best solution. And we've even had...
I would say, wouldn't you say that that's like, for most part, someone coming out of college, it's probably... Yeah, great. That's what I grab. That's what I kind of recommend folks to, like that rotational kind of story.
It's hard to go into a PM or even a pre-com estimating role and not really understand how the building's put together or what the plumber needs to do his job efficiently. Mm-hmm. We Donnie and I call it getting your teeth kicked in a little bit. Mm-hmm. You're going to go out there and you're trying to motivate a person that might have 20 or 30 years in the trades. You're not going to tell them how to be a plumber, but you've got to explain what the expectations are, whether it's schedule or hopefully not quality. But
and that goes
that's
back,
hard. Right?
Yeah, and that goes back to the personal skills being the most important thing, right?
Do more listening than talking. Yeah.
You know, but like if I put a gun to your head and made you choose, and it sounds like it's definitely either trades or assistant super with you, what would you say?
I would say assistant super because that's where you're going to learn a lot about different trades. Whereas, you know, you might come out of a boat deck and you're a great carpenter, but that's, you know, it's only 10 or 15% of the job when you really look at it.
Yeah. And now I'll push on you a little bit. You did feel like your time as a laborer really helped inform your perspective, right? So, but do you feel like your point about the time it takes in the trade to get good at it is too long if your goal is to be a construction manager?
It all depends on what your ultimate goal is, because we've had plenty of, we've had plenty of union people that are in, you know, superintendency roles, not so much on the project management side, but they've certainly been there.
Yeah. Because I was like coaching it as like, you want to be the optimal CM. So whatever that means, whether it's a PX or
some people innately, like we have an individual in pre-construction that's been with us 20 years. He, outside of some co-op time, he really spent a lot of time in the field, but he knows how to put together large complex jobs with below grade, tricky situations, or, you know, logistically challenging jobs. He just, that's rare. And you can't plan on that, so you want to supplement it as much as you can along the way with training. And on the flip side, we've had we do have a somebody from pre-construction that felt like they wanted to go into the field, which he did for I think 3 years as an assistant super. You know, I don't want to go back to pre-con. When he comes back to pre-con, just the intimate knowledge in the field, you can hear it, you can feel it, he understands it, he's training the other pre-construction estimating people on that's not how it's done, so this is what you need to accommodate it. So you can see the difference. It's it's amazing.
It's because it's also shocking. Like I remember as a young assistant super, there was a change happening. I think we had like a custom condo, and there was a senior PM on the job, and I was talking to him out of, he's a senior mechanical PM. And I was talking to him on the phone while I was out there, and we were like weighing it out or whatever. And having the conversation with them, like the, I forget if we, I think we were saw cutting because it was duct work and we were coring. But having the conversation, it was clear that he didn't realize like what it took to do what we were doing. Because what he was saying is like, oh, just do this. And I'm like, you can't just do that.
I know it's going to be a disaster.
I don't remember what the thing was. And I'm like, but I knew enough that, okay, this person doesn't fundamentally understand how this process works. And I remember thinking, like, he was probably, like, you know, 50 years old or something like that, and I was 24, and I'm like, how is this person a senior PM and doesn't even understand what goes into coming to Slack?
It, you know, and it's fine if you don't know, but rely on the people that do to help you get through it. That's
right.
We're always going to run into those situations.
Yes.
That's a simple, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
you're right. Everybody knows that, how can I phrase this? There's more they need to know than they know, right? Everybody has so much to learn, 1,000%. But I think when it goes back to, like, you know, what makes the best, whatever you want to be, I think that field experience,
we build buildings.
Yeah, it goes such a long way. And I like, so one of the comments on the poll, there was actually a bunch of comments which I liked. Tim Katopoulos, TK, aka TK from John Moriarty, said, you know, even if it was just his way was, you know, even if it was just when you're in high school and you're helping some guy that's framing decks or working for a landscaper or whatever, he's like, just get a taste of the field. And then he said a field engineer for 3 to 5 years to understand the layout. Yeah. And he felt like that's kind of the optimal path. And I like that, you know, because you...
Yeah, the field engineering is, you learn a lot there too. It's I enjoyed that position a lot.
Yeah, and having to interface with the subs.
That was great.
On layout.
Pile drivers, eye workers, I mean, it's good stuff.
Yeah, understanding what they need and what's critical. So, you know, I kind of, out of everybody, I felt like that seemed to be...
Yeah, you're not looking for, you know, you don't, everybody comes, the good thing about the industry is everybody comes from different areas of expertise and they gravitated towards it for some reason. I get to blame my father. But we've had people that have done 10 years in the trades and have certainly moved into the superintendent role, run very large complex projects. So this, you know, it all depends on how much effort you're willing to put into it too and how far you want to go in your career. Cause, you know, we'll support it with training and certainly mentoring along the way.
But you got to have the motivation.
You can have the motivation. Yeah. You have to advocate for yourself first.
So the two themes that I kept hearing from people were trust and empowering. that Chris empowers people to do their job, to make decisions. If someone wanted to, let's say they're newer in a role that involves leadership, and that could just be a project manager, right? Now you have APMs under you. What do you think you do that empowers people to feel like, okay, Chris allows me to do this and to make decisions? And and then when they do go, and then this is kind of, these are two separate questions, but then also however you want to go about it. You know, when they do come to you with a tough decision, they feel like they really trust you or decision making.
It's very much an open door policy, and they've got to feel, they've got to understand you're authentic and you're gonna put your best foot forward to help them, right? If they don't feel safe, whether they gotta get yelled at or something, they're not. It's going to be as approachable, I think, is what I mean. So I think that's the first part, is they've got to feel comfortable coming to you with a problem, and then you've got to support them. Because ideally, our project teams, we try to set them up so they're autonomous. They're a business unit, essentially. If you're running a $100 million job, you are our business unit, and you are our front face to the client, particularly on that job. If something's going on, will the client pick up the phone, call me, your lead? Yeah, but. You don't want to get to that point.
And yeah.
You don't want the client to hear, I need to talk to my project executive every time there's a decision, because that's like buying a goddamn car. It's the worst experience out there. I'm going to talk to my manager. But giving them the training and the support, and we say it all the time, is stick up for each other. And that's kind of our tenet, is everybody's going to need help. And if a sub is being challenged, or even a client in a lot of situations, we need to come in and make sure that the employee feels supported in the decision-making process.
How do you support them when they're wrong?
Listen, everybody's going to make mistakes. You've got to support them when they're wrong. You've got to support them when they're right. And as long as we're learning from that, and they, if they do it two or three times after that, then it's not a mistake. It's a habit. So,
then that's a different conversation.
Yeah, that's a different conversation. Yep. Mm.
Here's the thing. Everybody I've ever worked for said they have an open door policy. Mm. How do you get people to believe that? Because it feels like and I talk to a fair amount of people. It's
a good question.
Universal that they do feel that way. How is it? I mean, you talked about it a little bit when you say, you're reflecting those things that you learned about, like, no one shooting at us.
Yeah.
Right?
A lot of it's listening. They want to be heard, so I just stop talking and listen and help understand where they're coming from. So there could be things going on at home, too, that you're not aware of that might be affecting the person's thought process. So, trying to get to know people at a personal level, as difficult as it is with a lot of people, you want to have some level of that, so you at least have a baseline as to, this person's child is having some problems or whatever it may be. It gives you a different lens, maybe to help them solve.
Yeah. I would say, having known you, not that I know you that well, but it's been north of 10 years and now it's at least
going back to the ISD days.
Yeah, so back to the ISD days, and that's, it's probably 50, at least 15 years, let's say. If someone was like your C-level, right, had a pretty decent sized company in the Boston market, I never felt like concerned about like reaching out. Sometimes if someone's like a senior, like a CEO, COO at some company, there's very much approach of like, I've got too much going on. I can't talk to my sister. You do have that approachable thing. And now I'm sure you're just as busy as those other CEOs that are, or COOs that are scattered and, well, what do you want? I've got 15 seconds, seconds to talk about,
That's one way to turn somebody off, right?
Yeah. And I have no, and I don't want those people to sit here because I'm not, like, that's not the energy I'm looking for,
that's a different series.
Yeah. I'm not looking to learn from that person, right? In the same way you weren't looking to learn from the supers that were screaming. Right, I felt that way too. I remember walking around, even as a young kid in the business, being like, listen, I don't fucking know anything.
What did I get myself into here?
Well, the thing is, I didn't know. I'm like, I don't know if I'm looking at anything, but I know that that doesn't work.
It kind of, sometimes it worked back then. If you're, you know, if the economy sucked and there wasn't a lot of work out there, you know, you do that now, you're not going to last 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, the employees won't last 2 minutes because they're going to go somewhere else.
Yeah. And you could get by with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But you weren't optimizing performance.
No. You know? Fear is a motivator for a short period of time.
Yeah. But how do you think you get that? So it sounds like listening. I think temperament.
Yeah, I got along with my father's temperament. It's a good thing.
Yeah. And then do you think the, when you were talking before about make the decision quickly, and then kind of, it's not going to be perfect, like them understanding, listen, I'm not hanging over you to say, oh, well, no, you shouldn't have done 7.5, you should have done 8, right?
Yeah.
You're like, no, you made a solid decision, you can back it up. Do you want to see that from them? Do you want to see, like, hey, yes, I want you to make a quick decision, but what was your logic behind that decision?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, and, you know, a lot of times if they do need to make a decision, you've got to give me enough input and perspective around to give an intelligent answer. Yeah, otherwise I'm shooting in the dark just like anybody else would be, but the context is important.
Yeah.
And I come from a somewhat humble background, and I'm not that bright. I didn't have any big plan, you know, I'm a state school educated, you know, it just, I found my way, and the company's been incredibly supportive over the past 30 plus years. I've never had to ask for anything, so that gives you a level of confidence that you're, again, it's to stick up for each other. I know even if I fuck up, Lee's got my back.
That's interesting. How much do you think the company you work for put you in the position? Like when I had Ryan Walsh on from JMA, and I had him on because I'll do these little episodes sometimes that I call like carving your own path.
Mm.
People that have jobs within construction firms that are atypical, right? Like they just didn't do I'm going to be a field engineer, assistant super, yeah, or APM, PM, PX, whatever. Like, is that kind of funnel you get?
Yeah, some people come in from the side.
Yeah. Or say, like, I started that way, but I almost look at myself, right? Started as an assistant super, became a super, had my own job, and then said, okay, I'm going to go work for the billing department, learn something different there, go to the AGC, learn something there, and then do codes and helping myself, right? And I kind of feel like, when you follow your own path rather than just kind of getting in the current, you end up happier.
If it's a path of your choosing, I would hope so.
Yeah. And I think like Ryan, to go back why I went there. So like I find that interesting. So I'll bring in people that do that. So like Ryan ended up in this hybrid role that I don't even know what you would call him.
I don't know Ryan. What is he?
Like deals with all the MEP trades,
common
jobs.
Yes.
He handles the VDC and coordination, but he also like handles all of the tech and decides like we're going to sign contracts with Autodesk, this and that. And then he's also their code person.
Mm-hmm.
So like if there's like
a lot of hats, yeah.
It's stunning,
especially when the side projects they do. Yeah.
And so like if there is. If they have to go to the state board appeals on code issues, like Ryan handles
really
that kind of stuff. Mm. And anyone that generally has code questions or code problems on the job, he's to handle all those. But like I said, then he's also deciding that they're going to use Autodesk, you know, BIM Blue, whatever the fuck.
Just the MEP stuff alone is an expertise that's hard to find. You throw in all that other stuff.
But the one thing that we talked about was Moriarty has no titles. So you're just...
Interesting organization, yeah.
Nobody across the organization, no one has a title. And I asked him, like, how much do you think, even if it's just subconsciously, did not having a title, like, allow you to... You know, he wasn't hamstrung.
Yeah, does it give you more freedom?
Oh, I'm a PM. Yeah. My job has to be, I have to do PM things. Like, no, you're an employee at JMA, we're building buildings.
That's very interesting because a lot of people are status oriented, right? They want that title.
They want this title. Yeah. Or you've often heard people, which blows my mind, like, that's not in my job description.
Yeah,
our job description is
you don't have a job
building.
Right. Exactly.
You know what I mean?
You don't have a job description.
So, like, that can be limiting, and that's also people's personality sometimes too. Like,
well, yeah, he's got a. There's a lot of constituencies he's dealing with at that level, and that's that can be taxing or it can be refreshing.
Yeah. So I look at that and say, like, okay, a company can in some way either promote or help certain attributes and be negative in some things. How much do you think Lee Kennedy, with their approach, and seems to be pretty reinforcing? Like, I used to see Lee quite a bit, even on social media. Like, I see a little less of it now, but for a stretch there, like, he was, anytime anybody at Lee Kennedy was posting something, like, he was looking at it, he was reading it, he was commenting on it, saying, like, oh, yeah, this is awesome. Like, good for you. Like, I definitely got the feeling that it was a supportive environment. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Jason Edick's always talking about the, what they call it, the GTF quotient.
GAF.
Give a fuck. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Like a give a fuck quotient. And, like, it seems like there's a, you know, a certain culture there.
Yeah. You need to do more of that, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much do you think that culture informed you, or helped you have, whether it was the confidence or the path to kind of take on these roles?
It was a huge part of it, because if they felt weary or concerned about putting you somewhere, well, that doesn't exactly set the job up for a confidence level. I can remember
it's not empowering,
right? But, you know, the conversations had, whether it was with Lee or whoever my direct supervisor was at the time, hey, we know this is going to be a stretch for you, but you pick up the phone if you have any problems and we'll be here. And that was the case. You could rely on that. So that's important to know. Again, somebody has your back.
Yeah. Now, I know you probably feel like you're being grilled here.
No.
But that's kind of where I'm going is, like, some of this stuff, especially with the leadership, it's all gray.
Yeah, right? it could be more gray.
You know, anyone says, hey, here's the formula to be a leader, well, it's full of shit.
We don't believe this then, yeah.
Right? And if I'm like a high energy person by nature, you know, if your leadership advice was to be even keeled and whatever, like, that's not going to work.
No,
for me,
it's
right?
Not going
to
fly. Yeah.
That's kind of what I like about the show, which is just to have all these different people with different perspectives and let the listeners hear from these people and say, oh, you know what? Like, I resonate with Chris. I
can see because there's 1,000 different personalities that have all been successful at some level. And
yeah. And what are they? And which one works for you as the listener? Right? Because there are some people that just their energy is so motivating. Right? Like,
yeah.
I had Hollis Adairy on.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know. You ever met him?
I haven't met him, no.
Okay. Like, I mean, if you ever need to Stillmer Beach, like, get in the room with Hollis Leary for like 5 minutes, and like, you're ready to run through.
It's inspiring, right?
A wall.
And that's just very different from how I am.
Yeah, and like, neither one is right or wrong, but like, you could look at that and say, oh, that's the ideal leader. People want to run through the wall. Well, that works for him.
Mm-hmm.
And you might need that person at one time, but if the shit's hitting the fan, you might need someone that's like, doing what that other guy is saying, and hey, listen,
calm the situation down a little
bit. It's all going to get fixed.
Yeah,
no one's shooting at us.
Yeah, so let's think through this thoroughly before we react.
Yeah, and not that Hollis can't do that, and not that can't motivate people.
Right?
But there's your...
It's all personality.
What's your right personality?
And there's different people that will gravitate towards different leaders because that fits their personality style better. And that's the good part about this business. All different types.
Yeah, there's no one path.
No one, right. Passionate about building and you're treating people right, then you're probably going to do pretty well.
Yeah. So it seemed like Lee Kennedy was empowering.
Yes. Yeah. I felt like they would be on.
They had your back.
Yeah, absolutely. And my VP of construction saying, you got to fuck up.
Yeah,
I expect it, but learn from it.
Yeah. Now, the type A people, because when I floated, hey, what questions do you want answered? a lot of what they told me about informed the questions I asked you, so I could kind of dig and get to the bottom of what they have liked about you. But then there's what I call the type A people, where they want directions, right? They're the people that they're the typical project manager, right? Like, all right, what order is going to be? I want to do what's A, what's B, what's C? How long should each one take? They're very like
regimented
and technical. I am. That's not me at all. Like, I'd rather talk about like what were you thinking about when you said that, right?
Yeah.
But for the technical people and for the type A's out there and the PMs, the direct questions were: what is your thought process when assembling teams?
It's a group process with us because, you know, Donnie Cook obviously understands the personalities out there in the field and who will work well together. A lot of it's availability, right? The timing of the job, who's available, who's got the technical skills to run it. And then you're really looking at the personality quotient, who's going to work well together. And if you have a young assistant super or assistant PM that's ready to make a step in a year or so, you want to make sure that person above them is going to prepare them for that. So there's a lot of sort of career development and career mapping that goes into whether it's stuff. I just had the conversation the other day. So-and-so hasn't seen a building come out of the ground yet. That's sort of what we have to focus on next. They've been on renovations for a couple of years. So trying to, it's a challenge, right? You put all those pieces together and then the job pushes 3 months and everything blows up and you've got to rejigger the team. But there's a lot of thought and effort that goes into how we do that.
That's interesting. So there's a couple things going on at the same time. You're like, what is the right recipe for the job? And okay, we have someone that's newer, not so strong. Let's put them with this person that's really strong. You know, so they can.
And that can go both ways. That can be, you know, I mentioned the super that was great with the client. It was less on a technical aspect. Bring in a very strong assistant super with, you know, heavy field engineering to support them, and it was a win-win-win across the board. So it can go both ways.
Yeah. So you have that recipe of what's right to the job, but then at the same time you're looking at it as individuals' career paths.
You have to, because they could be on that job for 1 to 2 years. So you know, if they feel like they're not gaining the knowledge they need to make the next step, they're going to get frustrated.
Yeah. And then Mike want to go somewhere else, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I remember talking to Mike Fish early on, and, you know, they were experiencing a ton of growth. And from what I know about him and, you know, the conversations I've had with him, I was like, you know, you don't seem to be a person that is, but grow for the sake of grow. Like, you know, like, why are you growing? And he's like, to be honest, he goes, if we don't grow, then our people don't have
its opportunity.
Yeah. He goes, if we're only one size, then we only need two PXs. There's a lot of people that would like to grow and become PXs.
Yeah, but tricking them if you don't have more work.
Yeah. So, and I was like, that's
feeding the machine.
Really interesting. But then it becomes like a runway train.
Well, you're on the treadmill. So you got to keep going because, you know, the opportunities come from new, whether it's a different type of project or more of them or bigger volume, whatever they be.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, you can't.
Yeah. Because it's not like it's no fault of the person, right?
Where no.
Like I want to take this next step in my career, and because we don't have those positions, like you can't fault them.
No, they're going to go find it.
Yeah.
Especially when they're younger, because it's easier for them to do it. You know, I'm not in mortgages. I don't have kids yet. So it's easier to jump where you think the opportunity might be better at the time. Yeah. And the economy, you know, the economy certainly plays into it. You know, since 2000, whatever, 9 or 10, it's been pretty good years here, so we haven't seen any major downturns in a long time. So there's a whole generation that hasn't seen that yet, because when you and I came up, it was, oh, shit, here's another recession. I can keep my goddamn head down and keep my mouth shut.
Yeah, no, for sure. Got a funny story about that is I had boss that called me stupid for going to the building department, right? On the exit interviews, right? And I was like, okay, that's interesting. And 2 years later, he was laid off. So I was like, oh, who's stupid now?
They eat all the time.
I'm
sure pension.
Yeah, exactly. Again, listener question. What are some data-based ways you make decisions?
More and more every day now. I mean,
Oh, I like that answer.
Well,
it's hard to harness. But the quality control was certainly one, particularly when we're looking at subcontractors. Jason's input on safety is a good example. You're trying to be competitive on a bid, and based on all the data, you had a particular sub that had a great number on a job, but their safety was a little
finger in the pot. So you're saying Jason with the...
A particular sub that was questionable on their safety, but had a very competitive number. And we approached the owner and said, you can benefit from this number, but we're going to need a safety person essentially full-time managing them to make sure they're doing it right, because the high-risk stuff, scaffolding, and all that. Sold. Like that. And we had the data. We had the numbers. They didn't want the risk. They didn't want an accident. They were very proactive on safety themselves as clients. So... That's a very powerful message, whereas, just taking a low number to take a low number. Well, we need to supplement this person somehow. We need to get compensated for it. So that's a good one. We use a lot of historical data on the schedules. Our schedule people are great about keeping track of, if we're doing a wood frame job, here's how much wood framing we can do in a week, how many square feet we can do. So when we're looking at schedules, even at a real conceptual level, we can put together a pretty tight proposal based on, complete lack of information, but we have confidence going into it.
So you're tracking, as best you can, timing of, square feet installed per day.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
All that kind of stuff. Yep. And is that a Procore, or is it just an Excel?
They keep it in Excel just based on the schedule information they have off of P6. So, it's sort of its own little database, but...
You using Procore to offer any kind of data, or?
Yeah, we use a lot for tracking, particularly, expectations from design teams on if they're not, are they responding to our RFIs in a timely manner? Are they responding to submittals in a timely manner? Because if we don't get that information when we need it, the schedule suffers, right? So it's a conversation on, we need you picking up. Do you need more help? Should we approach the owner together to get you more support, because it's less expensive to put a little bit more architecture time at the beginning of the project where you need it than doing overtime with, 10 electricians every Saturday for 6 weeks, right? So, yeah, we harness that quite a bit. At least we track it quite a bit, and then we use it when we need to.
Okay. Then, did you work on anything or take any classes? Did you read any books, take any classes to help with this?
Like I said, I'm always doing the technical, the technical stuff and the code upgrade. But I just recently took a course at Harvard Business School for organizational structure, which was really good. So yeah, I hadn't done that in a while. It was very informal, but it was a good class.
Yeah. Any good nuggets?
Just a different perspective. It was really case study based.
Okay.
On bigger corporations and to see what they went through and how they managed it, but no solid nuggets. It was just a good foundation for looking at things sort of on a bigger scale.
Okay. To get out of the not being looking at things so narrow.
I've been here for, I've been with the same company for so long. It's that's a good thing, but it's also a little bit restricting a broader perspective. So yeah. That's one way I get it.
Okay. And then
certifications to FIAS, that's